You are listening to the cycling podcast, at the Tour de France in association with RAFA, the fastest closing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with RAFA in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam. Stage 8, today we're in Saint-Étienne.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are at our hotel near Saint-Étienne Airport, and we are sharing this evening with Team CCC, UAE Team Emirates, Sunweb, and Cofidis. And that, in fact, right outside my room is the Cofidis truck, which is making a very loud humming noise, which I hope will be turned off and quiet by 9:30 this evening, bedtime.
we're also on the outskirts of Saint-Étienne, and we've witnessed a cracking stage today, a real belter, one for the ages, I think. I mean, so many storylines today. We had a quite epic solo escape and win. We had two Frenchmen chasing behind. We had a crash for the defending champion. So much to pack into your tail of the attack, Lionel.
Indeed. Well, if yesterday's snooze fest is the price to pay for Thursday's finish at La Planche des Belles Filles and today's humdinger, then so be it, I say. I can cope with a stage like that every other day. I'm not sure I could cope with a stage like that every day. It'd be too much. It was stage 8 from Mâcon to Saint-Étienne. It was 200 kilometres exactly. The news we heard last night after we'd recorded was that TJ Van Garderen of EF Education First is out of the tour. The x-ray that he had after the stage revealed that he had cracked a bone in his hand, so he went home, didn't start the stage this morning. And the stage itself, well, four men in the break, and it was four breakaway specialists, really. Thomas de Gendt of Lotto Soudal, Alessandro De Marchi of CCC, Ben King of Dimension Data, and Nicky Terpstra of Total Direct Energy. And, well, they were away all day. A really hard day, up and down, beautiful countryside at times. Reminded me of a sort of 1980s Tour de France stage. The roads were small and narrow and attractive. Sunweb did a lot of time on the front with one man doing the chasing on his own. Then EF Education First and Astana joined forces. And it really all kicked off on the approach to the final climb, the Côte de la Jaillère. Thumbs up from Francois, thank you. No one would know that was a second take at that, would
I just realised I didn't introduce Francois at the start, did I? I didn't say who we all were.
We know who Francois is.
You're Lionel, I'm Richard, and that's Francois.
Yeah.
We'll be hearing a lot from him in a moment or two.
Anyway, just as all that was happening, there was a crash, and defending champion Geraint Thomas went down with some Ineos teammates and Mike Woods of EF Education First. Now, afterwards, Thomas was sort of subtly pointing the finger at Woods, suggesting that perhaps he had caused that crash. Thomas did get back on as they got onto the climb. By this point, De Gendt and De Marchi were the last two men away in front, and De Gendt went solo from the bottom of the climb and then held on to the finish, really against all the odds, because behind, Julian Alaphilippe went for the bonus seconds on the top of the climb, and Thibaut Pinot was out like a greyhound out of the traps in Alaphilippe's wheel. So we had this fantastic pursuit between De Gendt and Alaphilippe and Pinot, and then the group behind. And it means that Julian Alaphilippe is back in yellow. So on Bastille Day tomorrow, we have a Frenchman in yellow and a Frenchman on the yellow jersey, because today's special edition Maillot Jaune features Bernard Hinault. Ciccone has slipped down to second, 23 seconds behind Alaphilippe. And Thibaut Pinot is the big winner in the GC, because he's climbed from seventh to third and is only 19 seconds. He's now 19 seconds ahead of Geraint Thomas. People who lost ground today, Vincenzo Nibali, not that we were expecting him to challenge for the GC, but...
Were we not?
I think the line was stage hunting, but you never know.
Well,
with Nibali,
yeah,
do you?
Francois wasn't so convinced of that, but...
No,
but
I was not. I'm absolutely.
Well, he lost almost 4.5 minutes. Mike Woods lost 14 minutes as a result of that crash, so not a great couple of days for EF Education First, although Rigoberto Urán is still well positioned. And Dylan Teuns of Bahrain Merida, who won at La Planche des Belles Filles a couple of days ago and was third this morning, he was in a group that came in 26 minutes down. So an absolutely barnstorming victory for Thomas de Gendt. His second Tour de France stage victory. And Richard, as we were recalling in the car on the way from the finish to our hotel, the first was on Mont Ventoux in 2016, but of course that was overshadowed somewhat by the fact that the finish line was brought down the mountain because of high winds, and of course the extraordinary crash which caused Chris Froome to run up the mountain. So De Gendt probably didn't get the plaudits then that he deserved, but tonight surely no one can say anything other than that was the performance of a grand champion. And Richard, you made the point in the car that De Gendt really is an exceptionally talented rider who chooses to ride in an aggressive way, going in breakaways on difficult days, rather than sort of ride anonymously into a top 10 position, which you would think he would be capable of doing.
Yeah, we're going to talk a lot about Thomas De Gendt, I think, but watching those, as you say, they were all breakaway specialists, all really strong riders, those four in the front, and that made it really interesting because you know, a lot sometimes, I keep my voice in because some of the riders in question are around us, but the riders chasing behind are not of the same calibre in some cases. And so when the gap is seeing the same, you're thinking, well, the guys in front are measuring their effort and they're keeping something back for the finale. And De Gendt, you know, when you looked at the four of them, De Gendt, he's got a fantastic position on the bike. He's very aerodynamic. He's got a huge engine. He's finished up there in GC and the Giro. He could be a GC rider and maybe target top 10s in Grand Tours, but instead he uses his talent in quite an unusual way to target these incredible stage victories. And yeah, the Mont Ventoux win certainly was overshadowed by what happened further down the mountain with Chris Froome. So I think he'll get the credit that he deserves for today's stage win.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, à the Tour de France in association with Rafa. The fastest closing in a world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam.
I like because it's comfortable and also because we have more bib short. We have winter bib short, summer bib short, so can I use more bib short for the winter, for summer, for all. Hi, I'm Sasha Modolo and Team AF Education First. The chamois also is very comfortable. For me, it's the best bib short in the world.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our headline sponsor. Now this morning, before the stage, I watched their latest EF Gone Racing film with Mike Woods. Unfortunate timing away because he lost 14 minutes today. However, I don't think he was coming here for GC, and I don't think that will really matter. I gather he's not too badly hurt after his crash, the same crash that involved Geraint Thomas and most of Team Ineos. So, you know, he'll be okay to support Rigoberto Urán and perhaps even, you know, go for a stage win himself in the mountains when we get to the high mountains. But the film is well worth a look. Go to rafa.cc or the Rafa channel on YouTube. He's a very engaging and interesting character, Mike Woods, so it's a nice little insight into who he is, riding his first Tour de France. And he says in the film just how desperate he was to ride the Tour. He's not, you know, he turned pro quite late and won't have too many chances to ride it. So here he is. I'll probably speak to him quite a lot during this Tour. But what a stage today, and what a win by Thomas De Gendt. You know, when we saw the four riders in the breakaway, Ben King obviously won two pretty phenomenal stages at the Vuelta last year, Nicky Terpstra, last year's Tour of Flanders winner, Alessandro De Marchi, who you know, is a bit of a specialist at this type of attack. And it was interesting at the finish that Thomas De Gendt said that he was sorry that De Marchi had cracked and hadn't been able to stay with him. He said he would have liked to have, you know, sprinted it out for the win with him. I guess he would have liked to have won. He would have liked to have been beaten by De Marchi.
Really easy to say when you've won the stage, that, isn't it? But,
yeah,
you know, but I'm not doubting the sincerity. But
you know, I think it's interesting. These guys, they're all strong riders, but they're also all going to commit 100% to a breakaway like that. And I think they are rivals, but they're also colleagues in a situation like that. And they appreciate that, don't they? But what a performance from De Gendt, who held off and didn't really lose much time on the chasing duo behind.
No, well, the chasing duo were, I mean, there was class in that chasing duo, wasn't there? Julian Alaphilippe and Thibaut Pinot. Alaphilippe chasing the yellow jersey again, Pinot trying to make gains in the GC, and not to discount Alaphilippe, but Pino is now kind of the de facto leader of the tour, isn't he? He's ahead of everybody else on GC. But at the finish, well, the delight around the Lotto Soudal bus was obvious. We're actually almost toasting to Gent's win with a glass of Affligem, which is only around half an hour or so away from St Nicholas, where de Gent was born. Seems quite appropriate, even though we're in France.
Might have another one.
But the way Lotto Soudal have raced in this first week has been really exhilarating. I mean, Wellens and De Gendt, roommates, they went on that wacky adventure riding home from Il Lombardia back to Belgium last October, and they were in the break together a few days ago.
They'll do it again, they said. Yeah, they announced they would do it again this year.
Well, why not? I mean, De Gendt's win today was absolutely exceptional. And well, let's hear from a collection of people from Lotto Soudal. First of all, the general manager, Mark Sargeant, the boss of the team.
The sergeant
major of the team, although the most softly spoken sergeant.
The most
sergeant.
Gentle sergeant major you can imagine, yeah.
Then from John Lalong, who is kind of directing operations from the team car. Then from Roger Kluger, one of De Gendt's teammates.
I said it, incredible, when we saw them pulling like 1:30 to go, 1:30 left. We said this would be difficult. And then he went solo, and then we saw the last two guys, Alaphilippe and Pinot, coming. This is over, but they couldn't catch him. It was, I said, I used the word "du jamais vu" in French. Never seen this. If you keep those guys off, like Alaphilippe, Pinot, they didn't have to pull for the whole day, and they couldn't close the gap. I think it's one of the greatest wins I ever saw. We saw him winning on the Ventoux. I saw him winning Catalonia stages and other stages in the Tour, Giro, Vuelta. He won all three of those already a stage. But this is, we should rank it on top, I think.
Yeah, we know that. That's in his DNA, I think, to be offensive. And he already did it in the breakaway with Tim Wellens, but helping really. Thank you. Helping really team to get to the point there on this stage. Today it was his day. I think that it was clear for him since yesterday after the stage that for him it was the best day to go. There is other opportunities coming in the next 2 weeks, but this one was surely the best one to try. And yeah, being there in the first breakaway of the day with also three strong guys, because when you are going with Stepstra, the Marquis and King, you know that yeah, the level is pretty high and you are really focusing on big engines. So that was also the deal. But then after, to regulate until the end and to have enough energy to accelerate at the end, because resisting to guys like Pino and Alaphilippe, that's not always easy.
He always tries to go from the beginning. And I think, I don't know if it was his first attack or second, third attack, but it was from the very beginning, high speed. And even they chased for another 5 or 10 kilometers, but they stayed away. And so it was such a hard start. Knowing they're coming 7-8 climbs, 200K distance, bringing it home, you need a lot of strength for this. It was not easy. Like I said, the pace was actually quite hard. Even when we saw the group is gone and maybe the bunch takes it more easy. But then was still Sunweb and Bora. They went for the stage win. So I think Matthews won the bunch win, finished fourth or something. So then we said, they don't give enough time to them. So maybe it's not enough. But in the end, yeah, they were stronger in front.
And how much did you know about what was going on up front, and when did you hear that Thomas had won it?
Like 15k to go, I got information. So we finished 26 minutes down, so could be 15k from the finish, I knew. I mean, before I knew we were still in front, but then I was out of reach, out of distance with the radio, so I couldn't hear the final.
But that must have made the last 15 kilometres quite pleasant.
Yeah, for, let's say, 3 seconds, it was a better feeling in my legs, but then there was still 2-3 ramps coming up, especially the last one. And you know, it's still nice when we passed the last kilometer. I think he had a ceremony, so we hear over the speaker. It was good, it was a nice feeling, yeah.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
Today's episode of our Tour de France coverage is sponsored by the Watt Bike Atom. Richard and I both had a go on the Watt Bike in the run up to the Tour de France. We're not taking part in the tour this year.
Putting the final touches to our preparation for the Tour de France.
Well, we rode the London to Brighton, didn't we? I got back into the swing of things cycling-wise by riding on the Atom. And, well, when the equipment was delivered, the thing that struck me most was just what a solid, specific piece of kit it is. It's I've ridden a lot of turbo trainers, but the Watt Bike Atom is designed specifically for purpose. And let's hear me putting the Watt Bike through its paces, or should it be that the Watt Bike was putting me through my paces?
So I have finished my first session on the Watt Bike. I've more or less got my breath back. I've more or less stopped sweating. And I now appreciate why it is such a substantial piece of equipment and why it's as steady as it is, and what an advantage that is, because I was able to really put as much effort in as I had without the front end of the bike wobbling about. And that seems to me a big improvement on some of the indoor training that I've done before. And the time trial bars, not a position that I'm terribly comfortable in or really that familiar with riding in, but it was nice to have the elbow pads there and rest my elbows on them and drape the towel across the front to catch the beadlets of sweat as I went through my efforts. But the overwhelming first impression is that this is a piece of equipment that is designed specifically for this purpose, and that is making the most of your indoor training time.
Well, as you can imagine, Richard, I was really putting the power down, and it was a relief that it was so sturdy. The
Watt
Bike.
A great testament to the Watt Bike that it was able to cope with the sort of power you were putting through it, Lionel.
Power or weight? Power to weight.
Power, weight to power.
Yeah, the thing about the Watt Bike I found was that you're not taking your own bike on and off a turbo trainer and having to set it up. The equipment is there and ready for you, especially if you're a bit short for time. You can just, I was just wheeling it out of the corner of my indoor training centre and my office and jumping on.
I don't know if this is true, and some of our listeners might correct me on this, but I've been told that it's not that good to use your carbon racing bike in a turbo trainer, that it's not really designed for the sorts of stresses that can put on it. And that's what I have tended to do. And so having a, as you say, a specific piece of kit gave me a bit of peace of mind on that score and allowed me to keep my bike for using out on the road. I enjoyed using it a lot.
Well, it struck me that the Watt Bike Atom in particular, it's a specific bike for a specific purpose. And if you're going to do indoor training all year round, it's cheaper than sort of buying a second bike to go out training on, isn't it? So if you want to buy a Watt Bike, go to wattbike.com. And if you want to get £100 worth of Sigma Sport vouchers, which you can receive with every Watt Bike Atom purchase before the end of July, go to wattbike.com/TCP100 and use the code TCP100 at the checkout to receive your vouchers. And TCP100 is TCP100 in numbers, 100.
Yeah, you guys were so enthusiastic about the game that, I couldn't say a thing. I was drinking my beer, listening to you, and but it was very interesting, so I'm glad. But no, just a quick few things. He already had won the stages in the three Grand Tours, but we tend to forget that he won up Stelvio, he won up Ventoux, won a great stage in Gijón on Vuelta a España. And my impression, as you said, he's kind of collecting these prestigious wins, like he's chasing classic wins instead of as you say, what's the point, when you're a rider like he is, to win or to finish 8th or 12th in a Grand Tour? He's going for the classic, like skiers go for, want to win in Kitzbühel or in Wengen or in these not great places. You feel that the Ghent, like, targets the things that will stay in history, like, oh, you remember that great stage in every time we'll go to Ventoux. I mean, his name is there on the stage. Saint-Étienne is no, how could I say it? Saint-Étienne is probably not a classic as such. It's not Ventoux, it's not Stelvio. But look at the guys who won here. It's always been in France, one of the capitals of bicycle. I mean, they made great bicycle. Greg LeMond, all these names were linked to Saint-Étienne. I remember Julian Gorospe winning a time trial here in the Tour when the team that was to become from Delgado, the endurance team was just building up. So it is kind of a classic cycling team. And to get back to what he said about DeMarchi, he said another thing about DeMarchi that was interesting. He said he's a kind of rider who doesn't think about victory before we get there, you know, because he said that when you were in the break with guys, sometimes like 50 kids from the finale, they're already thinking about winning, and then but they don't do what needs to be done to win. And he seemed to say that he or DeMarchi are kind of riders who kind of start thinking about victory in the last 200 meters, not before then, you know. And that's why, you know, this man is fascinating.
But Saint-Étienne is one of the hearts of French industry and one of the hearts of French sport because of the football team. And we were in the stadium, which was where the press room was this afternoon. The finish was just a few hundred meters away from the stadium. And Saint-Étienne have won the joint most titles in French football. The other team, François, being...
Olympique de Marseille, of course.
Thomas de Gendt deserves all the plaudits, really, that come his way. But there's so much else that went on today that, again, I don't think his win will be overshadowed. But there were a lot of other talking points. Obviously, Alaphilippe and Pinot behind, and Geraint Thomas as well, and his crash and his very strong recovery. And, you know, I think he was 10th on the stage in the end, and he was leading them into the finishing straight. He clearly was very strong, and I gather at the finish that what he was most angry about was that he didn't have the opportunity to go with Alaphilippe and Pinot when they went. So, you know, lots went on today. Pinot, another marker from him that he's in terrific form. And, you know, Alaphilippe is just irresistible, isn't he?
Well, Alaphilippe is a racer, and Pinot is showing himself as a racer. And, I mean, in terms of opening weeks of the Tour, this is the best opening week of the Tour that I can remember for a long time, certainly since we've been doing the podcast. I mean, there's been none of the kind of the strangulation tactics yet. We haven't seen one really dominant team. I mean, you know, De Koenig Quickstep have obviously done extremely well, so have Jumbo-Visma, but you know, they haven't their success hasn't come at the expense of the spectacle, which I think sometimes we do see in the Tour. The Tour is so important. I said earlier in the season, you know, often the Giro has the feel of a kind of a travel around Italy, and the Tour feels much more like business. But this feels like an event where people are prepared to take risks. And I think that it's a very subtle change, a very subtle introduction, but this bonus seconds on the top of the final climb today, and there's another one tomorrow, and there's one the other day, it's offering reward for people taking risk. And the genius of the bonus seconds is it doesn't matter if there's a couple of riders still up the road. If there's seconds available, that might be enough to tease out some aggression. And with the yellow jersey, it's so finely in the balance that the incentive for Alaphilippe to go for it was there. We actually asked Geert Van Bont this morning, sports director with De Koenig Quickstep, and Francois, I think, asked Davide Bramati, the other sports director, and they really played down the suggestion that Alaphilippe might target those seconds. But well, we now know not to trust a word they say at the start. They're not going to give their tactics away, but it's a little bit like nudge theory, isn't it? Or you tax things that you want to discourage, and you relax taxes on things you want to encourage. And by offering bonus seconds, and it certainly shaped the racing today. Otherwise, we might not have seen Alaphilippe make that move, because it was a long way from the finish, but because the seconds were available, it meant that if he got to the top and hoovered up some seconds, he would at least get something in the bag.
And there was a real air of panic behind as well. You know, the guys behind didn't really know what to do. You had Jakob Fuglsang, I thought, looked really sharp today, and he was up near the front. But they didn't know whether to commit themselves. At one point, Giulio Ciccone, the yellow jersey, went to the front to chase. There weren't enough bodies from other teams to really bridge that gap to Pinot and Alaphilippe. And, you know, I think Pinot especially, we've spoken in the past about his fear of descending. You were saying in the car today, Francois, how that may have been exaggerated. But there he is today with Alaphilippe, one of the best bike handlers and the most fearless descenders in the peloton. And it was you know, reasonably sort of technical descent with a few corners and so on. And Pinot had no problems at all.
Of course, I think he never actually had problem once, and it was kind of played, you know, beefed up quite a bit. And I mean, Pino in the past complained about, you know, people saying he couldn't descend because, I mean, it's not true. I mean, as we saw today, he's not, of course, as good as Alaphilippe in that. But and so going back to, the discussions we had this morning with the team directors and others, obviously, I don't think they were actually trying to, hide their plans or conceal anything. They were all saying, and it's true, that depending on the circumstances, everybody was expecting a break to form and to take shape, and it happened. There was a break, but it was only a four-man break. In that break, it was obvious that you have two, exceptional escapees in the Gent and the Marquis. Ben, with no, disregard to Nicky Terpstra as a great rider or Ben King, but it was obvious that at one stage, and it actually, I'm sure Alaphilippe, with a 10-man group up front fighting for stage victory, well, that then we wouldn't have seen Alaphilippe do anything, and we wouldn't have seen Pino going for it. Perhaps on top of it, maybe if the team Ineos and especially Geraint Thomas had not crashed,
absolutely,
maybe the risks Alaphilippe took wouldn't have happened, and maybe Pino would never have taken the risk to follow him. But he thought, and I think that because when we talked to them and to the team directors at the end of the stage, they all said it was actually the inspiration of the moment. Alaphilippe went because there were seconds up for grabs. Had there been five guys on top of them, there wouldn't been anything to grab. Same with Pino. When he saw that Thomas came back, obviously, given the fright they had, the team Ineos probably said, well, we're going to stand still and not try anything. But had they been in the mix, in this finale, probably Thomas would have gone with Pino. And so, I mean, a race of that caliber, of that excitement, is due to a lot of little details that change the thing. And I mean, Modu told you, and I talked to Yvon Madieu, who said the same. There was no plan whatsoever for Pino to follow, to try and go behind Alaphilippe. They knew Alaphilippe would attack if the circumstances permitted. They would attack on that last climb, but all of a sudden, Pino said, told them in the team, told the team car, okay, I'm going, and off he went. And finally, the interesting thing was that Yvon Madieu told me, if you look at the tour in the past couple of years, or maybe the past 5 or 6 years, there's not a huge amount of time difference in the big mountains, like we saw La Planche des Belles-Filles, like the leading leaders were pretty close. And every time you have a chance to take 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes on this kind of opportunity, you have to do it. And look at the amount of time Pino took over off the other leaders. He would never take 23 or 25 seconds off Geraint Thomas in the mountains.
No, it could be very valuable indeed. And it was a great bit of opportunism. You mentioned I spoke to Philippe Modoui, his sports director at Groupama FTJ at the finish. Let's hear what he had to say first.
We knew that somebody will jump on that last climb, and Thibaut was ready for that. It was a great opportunity because Julian was really there to catch back the yellow jersey. So we were sure that Julian was ready to pull till the line. And for Thibaut, it was a good fun in the village before the climb. I think Thomas Geraint had a crash, but then the race was still going on. EF and Astana was pulling strong, and when Thibaut saw Julian jumping over on the top of the climb to catch a few seconds, he was on the wheel, and then there is no way to wait anymore. That's the race.
So that's Philippe Modoui. Now, Francois, you spoke to Tom Steels, another sports director / coach at De Koninck Quick Step. Pino's partner in crime, of course, was Julian Alaphilippe of that team, who's now back in yellow for Bastille Day. We'll hear from Tom Steels.
Yeah, due to the characteristics of the course also, this is made for Alaphilippe. I mean, this is not too long climbs, steep climbs, and then with that final in the last kilometer, that's made for him. Mm-hmm. And then with the goal to taking the yellow back, he was super motivated, and he took the risk again, because it was not obvious to do it.
And how long can he keep it? And is the idea to keep it on his shoulders for as long as possible, or also Enric Mas?
For as long as possible, but we also saw, of course, Enric Mas is in a good shape, but that's still another story that's completely different. His race will start later, but we have yellow, and that's I mean, we can defend it now with a bit more space, but he took it back, and that's was goal number one.
That was Tom Steels on Alaphilippe, and I mean, a Frenchman in yellow on the 14th of July. That's a dream scenario for him, isn't it? And he's, well, I don't think anybody really knows still what he's capable of or what to expect from him as we get deeper into the race.
That's the thing. I mean, we one thing we know probably for sure now is that's the La Planche des Belles Filles scenario, like the guy who's in the yellow jersey at La Planche des Belles Filles takes it all the way to Paris. Well, I'm not saying obviously, you never know, but it seems very unlikely now that you know this happens again. For Alaphilippe once again, I mean, we knew from the start that you know he what the potential was, and it took a little bit of time for him. Remember his first tour, coming second behind Sagan, he was nearly there, but it didn't. And then up a gear last season, you know, with winning the Polka Dot, and what an amazing season, you know, Milan Sanremo, Strade Bianche. I mean, there's so many other Flèche Wallonne and stages in all the major stage races he took part in. Where I mean, obviously the third week in the high mountains in the Alps, look, you know, that's the level he's not got to yet, and he probably will never get to. But you never can tell with Alaphilippe.
You never can tell, and that was one of the questions he was asked today. You know, he's been on fire since January, and I'd love to know what sort of preparation he's done for the tour, whether he's, you know, how long he's been to altitude, and how much of a sacrifice he's made of other races that are important to him in order to come to the tour, giving himself the best chance at riding well here, or whether, you know, he's come back to the tour with the goal of stage wins, King of the Mountains. We don't know. Maybe we'll find out as we get into the race. But a lot of people in other teams are really unsure about what he might be capable of. The one point that's made, though, is that what we haven't had is the 40-minute plus climbs yet. And we know that Alaphilippe can ride well on a climb like La Planche des Belles Filles. It is, you know, in the Pyrenees and the Alps, the likes of the Tourmalet. How will he ride there? We don't know yet. But
I think he can ride those climbs well. My fear for him would be that there's nothing in the recent history of the Tour that we can compare this opening week to, really. And we talked in the Giro and in the Vuelta to an extent about how all those little efforts in a first week add up to something.
Is he doing a Simon Yates?
Well, I think it's going to be hard. I mean, the level and the intensity of the Tour is another half notch up from the Giro, and I just think that last 9 days of the Tour is so demanding. We haven't even got to the high bits yet, where we go across altitude, and I still think that the Tour will be won by the teams and the riders that are just holding back a bit at the moment.
Of course.
This is also my fear for Pinot, because as swashbuckling as it was today, and as good as he looked on La Planche des Belles Filles, we haven't seen him do that. We haven't really seen anyone do that. The pattern of the Tour in the last 6 years or so, going back to really Cadel Evans was the last Tour where it sort of swung one way or the other. From really Wiggins onwards, the Tour has been won in the same way, whether by Wiggins or by Froome or by Nibali, and that has been taking control of the race on the first mountain stage and holding all the way to Paris and really suffocating and just sort of eliminating risk and potential danger. And we're not seeing that at all. And so I think the rule book goes out of the window somewhat.
Kind of disagree with that, because I mean Pinot has never been in such, I mean, Pinot finished in the top three of the Tour already. He's never been so relaxed. So if he goes today, it's because he feels strong. He has a very strong team around him, the best he's ever had, with Gaudu, I mean, Reichenbach, Rudi Möller. I mean, there are guys, they might seem, you know, oh well, you know, but we'll see in the mountains. To me, it's obvious Pinot will finish in the top five. I mean, the top 10 is certain for me. The top five is quite certain, and the top three is already not far. He's never been in that position. You were talking about Modui. I was talking to the Maggio brothers the other day, and they say, we took on Modui because he's a relaxed guy, lots of experience. He already won the tour. He was with, you know, Alberto Contador and other prominent riders, and he really, they said, brought this kind of serenity inside the team and this ambition. So I wouldn't discount Pino at all. As for Alaphilippe, remember, you were mentioning 2011 Cadel Evans. Remember, Tommy Vogler finished fourth in the Tour de France, and is the same type of attacking rider as Alaphilippe is, only not as good. So
no, I mean, Alaphilippe's got a far better kind of record, of course, in races. So
I wouldn't. And remember, Greg Van Avermaet last year was riding in the front in the first week and the second week. And in the end, what did he do? He managed a top 20, well, almost a top 20 finish when he's not a mountaineer. So I don't think Julien Alaphilippe will finish 53rd or something. He won't be probably not in the top 10, but he's probably going to ride the best tour of his career.
I don't dispute that, really, and I'm not saying that Pino is somehow making sort of mistakes that will come back to haunt him. I'm just saying that we haven't seen this, and we haven't seen it from... We can't say, oh, well, Pino's done this before, so all is good. I mean, as much as they will be confident, I mean, Pino is class, but there's a difference for me in the Tour de France that when, you know, these are still the early days. I mean, I don't want to just quote... Daniel Free, but so far, you know, Pino's kind of on the podium in the Dauphiné. That's what's been achieved so far. There is a long, long way to go.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2019 Tour de France is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport. You can get your 25% off at scienceinsport.com. If you use the code SISCP25, and if you go to scienceandsport.com/signup, you can sign up for their incredible competition to win a day in the Team Ineos car at either the Vuelta a España or the Tour of Britain. A range of great prizes being offered around that includes two nights accommodation, transport, and £400 spending money, and there's some great runners-up prizes as
Can
well.
Can I ask a question about that prize? Is the stage predetermined, or does the competition winner get to choose? Can we find that out for a subsequent?
I don't know the answers to those. I suspect, Lionel, that it will depend on when there's a space available in the team car, which I don't imagine Team Ineos know at this stage. As we know, these things, you know, they'll have a day available, and I guess it'll be down to them rather than down to the competition winner. But do go to scienceinsport.com/signup to enter that incredible competition. Now, the other talking point today is Geraint Thomas and his crash. And you know, one of the ingredients in this fascinating first week of the tour and this sense of openness is, you know, a sense of vulnerability around Team Ineos, what was Team Sky. And, you know, not to labour the point about, you know, Geraint Thomas crashing a lot, because he often crashes and it's not his fault, such as today. There was nothing that he did wrong. And, you know, most of his team came off. Jenny Moscon's bike was sliced in two. And, you know, he got back on relatively easily on a tough finish when, you know, the roads were narrow and twisting and they were having to navigate around team cars. They did a pretty good job. You know, Dylan van Baarle was there. Castrovieco was there, and Wout Poels in the end. And Wout Poels just kind of dropped him off within touching distance of the bunch, and Thomas got back on, and no damage done. He's hurt his arm a little bit, but he seems okay. So, you know, they escaped from jail, as it were. But, you know, there are just these questions. He's a joint leader with Egan Bernal. Could Bernal have maybe gone with Alaphilippe and Pino? Well, apparently not, but, you know, nobody could. So there just isn't this air of invulnerability around Team Ineos that there has been around Team Sky.
And what do you think of Bernal? Because I don't get the impression that he's, you know, the impregnable kind of...
No, but this is not... We're not in his terrain yet, are we? And
no,
we're not in these high mountains. So we could see a different pattern
maybe,
emerge.
Maybe he's the one that just sort of sitting tight for a week and just getting through and not losing anything and not risking anything at the
of
moment.
Of course. I mean, you know, well, that was the case at La Planche des Belles Filles. I mean, there were two reasons why the last stretch, as I said at the time, didn't make it possible to, you know, go up on your pedals, and you had to stay in the saddle, which is not this, you know, what it does best in the mountains. And as soon as we'll get closer to 2,000 meters high, that's when he's in his terrain, he's in his natural altitude, I was about to say. So for me, however strong Pinot looks, and I said it, and I think he can aim at a podium, Bernal and Thomas remain the obvious favorites. But what is true is, in the past, as you said, we saw Team Sky control the bunch, even in the first stages, mm-hmm. even sometimes in the sprints. We saw them at the front yesterday. They did what they had to do, you know, to take their leaders out of trouble. And 1 kilometer, the 3 kilometer mark happened, which is the mark when, if you crash, you know, in the same time they kind of, you know, went back and let the sprinters do their job. So they've been more discreet in their approach, for the time being, as efficient, like you said, in times of trouble, they were there. And the way you know, Thomas was brought back, well, especially by Wout Poels in that you know, last section, well, proved that, you know, they're still very, very efficient as a team.
Well, I spoke to Nicolas Portal, the sports director at Team Ineos, at the finish. A scare for them today. Here's what he said.
That was a big scare, I guess, today. Yes. How is Garin after his crash?
Yeah, I think it's fine. It's fine. He came back super quick with the guys. Really, really quick, actually. Also, it will take longer than that. But chapeau. I think so the guys went wait for him. I mean, they wait because anyway, they all crash except Egan. They have to stop. They've been stopped by the crash. And then I think it was Castro Viejo, Wout Poels, and Dylan Van Baarle. They bring him back as far as they could. The last one was actually Wout, just going super, super fast on the climb. He left, about 30 meters from the bunch, but from the back of the bunch and the first place, it was like a good 100 meters. So he had to keep going, and I think he feels frustrated because I think when you feel frustrated, it's because you know you've been strong and something went away from your hands and you could not actually do anything else. And he was just on the limit. He's been going quicker than anyone almost all the climb, and he saw the attack and he's like just frustrated. He could not follow. He was on the limit. But listen, at the end, there's no any major issue apparently. Egan is good. The guy was good. Something like I told us, they know. On the bottom of the last climb, we have all the team except Luke. That's just fantastic. So it's 20 seconds.
How impressed were you by Pino today?
Yeah, good. I mean, for me, to be honest, I know it's good. We know it's good. So we not impressed. But I mean, I'm not impressed. Yeah, we knew he's capable to do it. So it's just saying, like, okay, he's on the top form for sure.
Could Bernal have gone with him then? Or
it's hard to know. I mean, I didn't talk to Egan. Like I said before, you know, and he's not the only one not follow this attack. There's all the secondary and they couldn't follow. So you might be a little bit blocked or whatever, or just on the limit and say, right, where I should go is still, you know, few K to go, and he was also Jay coming back. I have no teammates, so I don't know. But he's been going so quick, and Alaphilippe and Pino, they're so punchy. And sometimes, you know, I mean, fair play to them. They've been doing both. They're being where they went. Must be pretty exciting on TV.
And do we expect another stage like this tomorrow?
It could be also. I think tomorrow for me seems like a punchy one also, especially when they finish with this. Hilly parts. So in general, when you start to do a stage like this, the next day is or sometimes copy and paste, you know, so let's see. But to be honest, today was a lot of guys really retired. It's been really, really hard, so I will see how it's tomorrow.
Outside the team bus, Wiz.
Can you clear up how we say your name in Danish and how we say your name in English?
Yeah, so in Danish it's Michael Mørkøv, but I'm all fine with the more international name Michael, and obviously the second name Mørkøv is a bit hard to put together with Michael, so yeah, it sounds a bit Russian, but Mørkøv is probably the best way to say it, Michael Mørkøv.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Our listeners voted you their Pedler de Charme for a week.
Cool.
One of the Tour de France.
Again.
Again, have you won it before?
Yeah, I had it like, was it maybe in 14?
Yeah, I think that's right, actually. Yeah. The old style t-shirt.
Actually, I used the t-shirt just a few weeks ago.
Clean your bike?
No. I saved it quite nicely, and then just some week ago I found it again, and I had it on for a day.
Excellent. Well, here's another one.
Thank you.
I'll get a quick picture of you.
So, you were nominated by one of our listeners who was in Brussels, and at the sign-on noticed that you stopped to talk to a lot of the disabled fans as you came back down from the sign-on. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, in Brussels there was a lot of people, and I was there early for sign-in, and obviously I was just passing by a few guys giving autograph, and there was an area with some disabled guys, and there was seemed to be really big cycling fans, so it was a really big pleasure to give them an autograph and a picture.
You have to do a lot of that on the tour, I guess, signing autographs every day. It's part of the job. But are there some mornings when you think, oh, I just want to sign on and just stay in my own zone?
Yeah, so unfortunately, sometimes we don't have much time before the start, and it can be a bit stressful. We have a meeting, we have to prepare for the race. Maybe we are very focused for the race itself. And for me personally, it's touching my heart when I have to pass, especially small kids asking for autograph, and I don't have the time for it. But I can't even imagine how it must be to be like Julian Alaphilippe or Sagan, who can probably time that feeling by 1,000.
Yeah, indeed. You're in the Danish national champions jersey. Does that feel like a big honour when you're here? It makes you instantly recognisable, I guess, for the Danish fans as well.
Absolutely, it's a huge honour, and I was really emotional about it when I realized I won it a few weeks ago to get the chance to ride it in here in the Tour de France. It's my third title in Denmark, but the first time I've been able to also be selected for Tour de France on the same year. And especially the last couple of days, there's been a lot of Danish fans here, and I'm very proud to wear our flag in the peloton. And I'm a huge cycling fan myself, so I was for many years always hoping that the winner of the Danish Championship will go to the Tour, and now it's myself.
You've had one win already, and then yesterday Elia had a flat tyre in the finish. Did you know yesterday you had the flat tyre?
No, I only realised when we came back to the bus. So I just let him out, and it seemed to be a very perfect setup we succeeded with. And I was surprised to see how he lost speed in the sprint. Could have been the legs. Obviously, it's on a very high level that we are competing here. But when I came to the bus and saw that he was probably having less than half of his pressure in the front wheel, there's no doubt that he would have no chance to win against such a good sprinters.
Did you watch any of the Giro and see every day? Well, Elia crossed the line in the lead once but was disqualified, and then it was a case of bad luck or bad positioning or not quite getting everything right. Were you watching at home thinking I could get in there and make a difference?
Yeah, sort of. It was a bit hard to watch from home because I could just see, like everybody else, that something was not working right. It just seems like the team was not working in the same direction. So the guys who helped in the sprint there did their best, but they was kind of working in different directions. And I know now Elia for quite some time, and I know he's a guy who needs confidence and peace around him and confidence. And I would have loved to be around him and maybe help him in the Giro as well.
Lastly, it's this job that you've grown into come relatively late in your career. Do you kind of think, oh, all those years I could have been the lead-out man for other people? Was it something you knew you were good at, or is it something that you experience teaches you over the years?
Yeah, so basically I was always admired by sprints, and then also in the sprints was the places where I made my own results. So basically I am a sprinter, but I turned pro in a Danish team, Saxo Bank, and there it was always a big focus on the GC, the climbs and everything. So I kind of turned more into be like a climber. To be selected for Tour de France, you need to be climbing really well there. So for some years I was more like a domestic, especially for like a Contador and other GC guys. And then when I finished with Saxo, I went to Katusha as a lead out for Christoph. and now I really found my spot in the peloton. So yeah, I wish I could have changed that a bit earlier, but I'm still happy with what I have discovered and tried doing my years as a pro now.
What's the feeling of satisfaction when everything goes perfectly and the rider that you're leading out gets across the line first?
Yeah, so that's the best feeling in the world, and I have to say that from the position I am now, when I see Elia raise his arms, is as close as it can be to winning a race myself. I really feel happy when we win as a team, and I feel also it's my victory when we succeed.
Well, that was Michael Morkov, our first Pedaleur de Charme of the Tour de France, and your latest subject of your outside the team bus feature, Lionel.
Eight down. Well, it's like musical chairs, isn't it? Maybe one team should miss out after all, or would that be too cruel?
Nobody wants to go home from the Tour de France having not featured in outside the team bus.
No, they don't, do they?
I mean, honestly,
we'll have to do a special one on the Monday, you know, if
outside the nightclub on the final night. That's
right, yeah.
Outside the 94 from Watford to Harpenden. we can improvise somehow. But anyway, that was Michael Morkov. We're not going to carry on for too much longer. But
no.
I did my own outside the team bus this morning, and I spoke to Dave Brailsford because I remembered that he, as a young aspiring cyclist, based himself here in St Etienne and lived here for at least a couple of years. So I asked him about his memories of the place and of his time here. A place you know well, St Etienne. Tell us again about your history with St Etienne.
Well, when I was a young guy, I left home with a dream of trying to win a Tour de France. Pretty naive at the time when I look at it, you know, having grown up in Wales. Set off with my bike and a box, rucksack. I got a ticket to Grenoble, got to Grenoble. Thought, wow, okay, what am I going to do now? And in the end, because the long story short, I went to the end of a bike race, end of a pro bike race, and basically went up to the team with the nicest kit and asked him if I could ride for them. And they kind of fell about laughing, really. Didn't really understand, I don't think, what I was trying to say. I couldn't speak any French. And I got passed from team to team. And then a guy called Pierre Rivery eventually turned around and said, look, you know, here's an address. If you come down here, you can train with a team. And, you know, we're in St Etienne. Come and see us, you know. And I think he just took pity on me, never thought he'd see me again. So that was it. I was on the train, went from, I was down in Grenoble area, went across to St Etienne, found this little place where the team, like the clubhouse was actually. And so that was it. They all turned up. I was there. He was a bit surprised to see me. And off I went training with him and ended up staying there for 3 years. And absolutely loved it. Loved St Etienne. Reminded me a lot of Sheffield actually. You know,
industrial city,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, so industrial and steel, coal, and the when all the bikes used to be made in Europe rather than abroad. Now that it was very much the heartland of the cycle industry and the cycle components industry as well. So Strong Light, you know, Vitus were there. Francois, there was a lot of good frame builders in the day. You know, where obviously it was more about all the guys who were racing. You had your frames built for you, so you'd have a host of you know, artisan frame builders.
Were you there in 85 when the Tour de France finished in St Etienne?
I was there late, a little bit later than that, and but I was there. I remember Malcolm Elliott and all of it, and it was more sort of Paris-Nice time. Sean Kelly, of course, who kept winning Paris-Nice for fun in those days, and Stephen Roach, and there was quite a batch of Joey McLaughlin in the, you know, I can remember him at one point being there, and all those kind of guys. And it was just, I was so lonely when I was there. In the first phase of being there, I didn't speak French, I didn't really know anybody, didn't have a television, didn't have a phone, you know, I was really lonely. But I was going to stick it out, you know, but I loved what I was doing. I mean, you know, just riding, training and racing. But to start with, that first phase is probably the loneliest period of my life, really. But then once I picked the language up and got to know people and started to build a little community, then of course it goes from strength to strength. So anytime you saw anybody British, it was like, I couldn't believe it, you know. So even though it didn't mean much to them at the time, the little, I can remember sitting on the bonnet of a car, or Malcolm Elliott was sitting on the bonnet of a car, and Sean Kelly was there, and like Sean Kelly was like an idol of mine, you know, at the time. And I went over and sheepishly kind of went up to him and said hello. And he was fantastic. He chatted away to me, what are you doing here? You know, he's like, well, what the hell are you doing here? And it's quite a, you know, it's not a tourist kind of area. It's quite industrial, like you said. But it's funny because you just don't forget things like that, do you? You know, and quite often I look at our lads and you see young lads coming up to them and whilst it might not be a big deal to them, I'm sure for some people, you've got to always remember what a big deal it is for younger people. But so it's always great to come back. I love coming back to St Etienne.
Kept in touch with anyone there?
Yeah, so I one of the best friends I've got, actually. So there's where I had this little apartment, and there was a little coffee shop next door. Well, as I say next door, just around the corner. And I was thrilled that you could read Le Keep with all the cycling in it, because you couldn't read anything in Britain. So this idea of being able to have a little coffee after training, sit there, look at the pictures. I knew all the writing was about racing. I didn't really properly understand at the time, but it felt great. And then after a little while, the guy who was the sort of bar manager, sort of the lead guy in there, came one day and he said, Velo? I said, yeah. And he said, moi aussi. And he said, tomorrow, 12 o'clock, we go training. I said, oh, okay. Yeah, I wasn't quite sure I'd really understood it. So I thought, okay. So I turned up at 12 o'clock in my kit, and I felt like I'm either going to, something's good going to happen here, or I'm going to look like a Burke. The guy's going to be wondering, what the hell am I doing standing here in my bike kit? Anyway, sure enough, he finished his shift. He went into the back, came out all kitted up, and off we went around the lanes of outside St Etienne. We rode along for hours, and we'd go along and he'd go, Bernardino. And I'd go, yeah, Bernardino. And then we'd sit for another half an hour saying nothing. But over time, so we kept on, we persevered with this, and over time, you know, I learned to speak French and start to communicate with him. And then him and Dominique, his wife, had their first child, and they asked me to be the godfather. So that was pretty nice, you know, so I did. And we've stayed in touch ever since. And we've always, I mean, he was mad about cycling and knew everybody in that area when it was very much the hub of cycling. And so quite often we have a good old chuckle about how on earth did you end up in that little shitty apartment in St Etienne racing your bike here? What on earth happened for you to go from there to here, where we are now? And we laugh about that. But I'm not sure either, really, let's face it.
Well, that was Dave Brailsford in a far more relaxed mood this morning, it has to be said, than he was at the finish, when it was all a little bit fraught outside the Team Ineos bus because it was a difficult day for them. And I mean, I mentioned the, you know, the sort of, it's all relative, but the vulnerability around that team. But the team itself, apart from the perception of the team by others or the perception of any weaknesses or cracks, I think it's a team as well that really likes and perhaps needs to be in control, and when things are not so in control, it can threaten the strength and the sort of unity they have.
No, just as you mentioned, I mean, Dave Brailsford is not the only rider, you know, to come to France to learn his trade and to have done it in Saint-Étienne. Alexandre Vinokourov, and when he came to France from Kazakhstan, signing with what is now AG2R, La Mondiale, he actually lived nearby in Sorbier. That's the small town where the race came through today, with his friend Andrei Kivilev, who was unfortunately killed in Paris-Nice. So there were quite a number of riders. There's been a tradition of cyclists, you know, living in this area, which is quite mountainous. Very often finishes on Paris-Nice in and around Saint-Étienne. So once again, yeah, just a quick one. This town has not got a great reputation for tourism. As I was telling you in the car, guys, I mean, it's changed quite a bit in the last 15 years. It was a very industrial town, you know, making weapons and bicycles and stuff. And it's become the French capital of design in the last 10 years. It's got a very strong university for that. It's got now a couple of museums of modern art. It's gradually transforming itself into a little bit like Leeds, you know, into a post-industrial city looking for something else. And it's got a nice Art Deco town center as well. They've rehabilitated as well. So if you're in the area, don't discount it as a place not to stop. It's okay.
And as you said, Lionel, the countryside around St Etienne is absolutely beautiful. It's a bit like Massif Central, isn't it? It just feels very remote and really quite rugged and quite stunning to look at.
Yeah, Francois mentioned André Kivilev there. People may not be familiar with who Kivilev was. He finished fourth in the Tour in 2001, riding for Cofidis, and in 2003 he crashed. It was a terrible crash on a kind of not really a descent, was it? It was kind of leveling out from the descent, and
he wobbled and fell, and that crash was the incident that finally persuaded the UCI to implement the compulsory wearing of helmets in races. Until that point, it hadn't been compulsory, but from that point on, everyone had to wear a helmet, and probably long overdue, that rule, really.
A final little question for you guys. Can you tell when, for the last time, we had a French leader of the Tour de France and another Frenchman on the podium?
You mean a Frenchman on the podium on the stage?
No, on the GC.
On the virtual podium.
Yeah, on the virtual podium.
The virtual podium.
Frenchman in the lead. Well, the last time before this year was Galopin in 2014, and so it wasn't then, obviously.
Yeah, no, it's quite a long time. I mean, we had two riders in the top three. The finale in the final day of the Tour 2014. But the last time there was a French leader and another guy in top three in the GC was in 2004, 15 years ago, and it was Tommy Voeckler and Sandy Cazard.
Well. It's looking good for the French so far, and tomorrow's set to be a great celebration.
Well, we're going to Bardet's birthplace tomorrow in Brioude.
Bardet's birthplace.
But unfortunately, it doesn't look like...
Bardet's sort of the forgotten man in a way at the moment. But François, you'll treat us also to a rendition of La Marseillaise tomorrow. It's something to look forward to for all the listeners to the podcast.
Well, it's going to be a great couple of days for music because François is wearing his Northern Soul t-shirt this evening and a blast of La Marseillaise tomorrow. What could be better?
Yeah, well, maybe that's what I should tell Romain Bardet. Keep the faith.
Any other business tonight, chaps? Before we go, just a quick shout out for our show at Harrogate. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Live events on the tab down the side and sign up for our show in Harrogate on the Friday night before the World Championships. We're going to be doing a tour of the UK in November and we hope to be announcing some of the places we'll be visiting and how to get tickets next week.
Yes, and the rest day is coming up on Tuesday and we will be doing our first press conference of the tour. If you would like to send us a question, please record a voice memo on your phone and send it to us on WhatsApp. The number is +44 797 133 8205 and you can also find that number on our Twitter biography. If you don't want to record a question, well, we prefer if you recorded a question, but if you really don't want to hear your voice in the podcast, send us an email, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com.
We had an interesting email from Kiara Gardner. We're going to save that for the press conference because it's in response to our pre-tour press conference. Thanks for your email, Kiara, and we will get onto that, I think, on the rest day when we do our Tour de France press conference. So keep your questions coming in and we'll say cheerio, not before saying a big thank you to some friends of the podcast. These people all signed up back in January. But thank you very much to Matt Smith, David Benton, Martin Bentley, Thomas Dale and David Tomlinson.
Also Alistair Marshall, Kevin Jones and Connor, Peter Hodgkinson, Gonzalo Pereira and Rob Wicks.
And a big thank you to our friends Richard Barnes, Ashley House, Ian Reddock, Rhys Davis and Alex Goldman. Ashley House, is
I
that
recognize
you in the sports?
Ashley House? It must be Ashley House. There can't be many Ashley Houses.
Thanks Ashley.
Ashley. We'll see. Thanks in person when we see you tomorrow. In the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Francois.
Merci.